Yeah, do you have it really quick? Okay. That is so weird.
That's right. You got backups to the backup. To
yep, that's why we do backups. All right, we good? Yeah. Okay, this is the time and place set for the workshop on proposed regulation pertaining to Assembly Bill 332, Student Loan Servicers, as described by the Notice of Workshop dated and posted on April 19, 2024. This workshop is scheduled for 10 a.m. and is being recorded. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, and the time is 10:02 a.m. Financial Institutions Division staff present at today's hearing, Commissioner Sandy O'Loughlin, Chief Deputy Attorney General Michael Detmer, Examiner and your coordinator for today, Jennifer Ramsey, and Examiner Devin Owens, and myself, Deputy Commissioner Mary Young. If you have not already done so, please take the time to mute your telephone or microphone until called upon by the coordinator to provide public comment. Also, please turn off your video. Those here in Las Vegas, please silence your phones and electronics. Again, this workshop is being recorded. If joining by web, please activate the chat by clicking the dialogue balloon and enter your information on the sign-in sheet for the meeting record. If joining by phone, please email FIDmaster at fid.state.nb.us to request to sign the form. This email address can also be found on the workshop notice. Those who wish to provide public comment here in the room, please come to the table when I begin the public comment portion of the workshop. It is important to emphasize that the purpose of this second workshop is to obtain input from all interested parties in the process of adopting regulations pursuant to AB 332. In today's workshop, we will be soliciting general comments regarding the subject matter contained in each section of the proposed regulation. I will be summarizing the sections of the proposed regulation today and will take comment on those specific sections after those sections have been read. We will now move on to item two on the agenda, public comment. This time is to provide general public comment for the record. If you wish to comment on a specific section of the proposed regulation, please hold your comment until we reach that specific section during the presentation. There will also be an opportunity to provide general public comment prior to closing of the workshop. There is no need to restate a comment already made. If you have written material that you would like to submit, please hand it to Devin Owens here in Las Vegas or email it to FIDmaster at fid.state.nb.us. Public comment will be limited to 3 minutes per person or less due to time constraints. Comments will first be taken from web participants and then phone participants and then comments from those here in Las Vegas. For those who joined us virtually, you may provide public comment by typing an X in the chat box or by calling the toll-free number on the agenda at 1-844-621-3956. Please wait to be recognized by the coordinator before unmuting your phone or microphone to comment. Clearly state and spell your first and last name and clearly state your business affiliation before you begin your comment. Do we have any comments from web participants?
We have Scott from the web.
Okay, Scott, please make sure you state and spell your first and last name and your business affiliation. Oh, you are on mute, sir.
Still can't hear you.
Still cannot hear you.
He doesn't look like he's muted.
Mic is showing that it's live.
Yeah.
Is the volume on?
It's the speakers, yeah.
Is it our speakers on?
Yeah. Go ahead and try it now.
The people in the meeting can hear.
Mr. McKinney, can you hear? All right, can you try that?
I can hear
you. There. Now we can hear you. Okay, perfect.
Okay. Well, thanks for the opportunity. Todd Buchanan, the Executive Director of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance. And I know I will have some comments on specific sections, but I just wanted to thank you all for the consideration of some previous comments that we have provided and note that those some updates have been made that I think are positive steps forward. And we really appreciate that, including alternate language on surety bonds, clarification about record retention provisions, especially as it relates to private federal education loans, where that those retention policies are sort of outside of our control. And then switching to more of an average versus a borrower level aggregation of data. Really appreciate those changes and your consideration of it. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment. Do we have anyone else that joined us by web?
We have no other web commenters.
Any that joined us by telephone?
We have no phone commenters.
Okay, and seeing none here in Las Vegas, we will move on to item 3 on the agenda, the presentation of the proposed regulation. We will now go over the changes made from the first workshop. After I summarize those sections, we will take comment on those sections. For efficiency reasons, I will group sections together. When it's time for comment, the same format as general public comment will be followed. Section 6, we changed the term licensee to student loan servicer, changed the retention period from 6 years to 2 years for student loan servicers to align with AB 332, and we clarified when the retention period will begin by adding the following language. Following the final payment on the student education loan or the reassignment of the student loan education loan, whichever occurs first. We added the language or federal to incorporate servicing of both private and federal student loans. We added the verbiage any other applicable documentation, disclosure, notice, or release required by Assembly Bill 332 to ensure all applicable documentation and disclosures were being retained. Section 7 is a new section for retention of records and files by a private education lender for 6 years after the termination of the private education loan account. In addition, this section includes what is considered a complete loan file. Section 9 revises the amount of the surety bond from $250,000 to a tiered amount based upon the dollar amount of servicing account activities conducted by the licensee in the preceding calendar year. The four tiers are from 0 to $50 million in loans serviced will require a surety bond in the amount of $50,000, $50 million in $1 to $100 million in loans serviced will require a surety bond in the amount of $75,000, $100 million in $1 to $250 million in loans serviced will require a surety bond in the amount of $100,000, and over $250 million in loans serviced will require a surety bond in the amount of $250,000. Section 10 provides language to clarify the exemption in Section 20 of AB 332 is an exemption from certain application procedures described in AB 332 and not an exemption from licensure. If anyone wishes to offer comments on Section 6, 7, 9, or 10, now's the time to do so. If you wish to make a comment on one of the proposed sections, please identify what section you are commenting on. Do we have any comments from those who joined us by web?
We have Scott from the web.
Okay, Scott, we are ready for your comment.
Sure, just a brief comment on Section 7 and subsection C as it relates to collecting monthly payment amounts. I don't know that this is a comment for the regulatory text itself, but just as y'all are looking at sort of implementation and examination surrounding this section, just wanted to highlight for you all that the as applicable is critical here, because oftentimes at origination, monthly income is not captured. Certainly servicers are happy to if they, during the process of working through loan modifications or other sort of monthly payment options that may include income based for payment or similar things, to the extent we capture those, we're happy to retain those. But I just want to make sure that it's clear that oftentimes, unless that contact is about sort of those repayment options at origination in particular, servicers may not capture or have that information to be able to provide, let alone retain. So just want to make that comment.
Okay, thank you for your comment. Do we have anybody else that joined us by web?
We have Winston from the web.
Winston, we are ready for your comment.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Winston Berkman Breen. My last name is Beesenboy, E-R-K-M-A-N hyphen another B-R-E-E-N. I'm with the Student Borrower Protection Center. I have two comments I'd like to make. The first is with respect to Section 6 and the edit that clarifies or that adds in the language private or federal loan, and that's in Section 6 just before, let's find it. Oh, in Section 6A, I guess it is, any correspondence or communication involving a private, and the addition is or federal education loan borrower or student loan borrower. And this is an example of, I think, a global sort of technical edit, which is that this is now somewhat redundant because student loan borrower includes both private and federal loans. So it's sort of repeating two types of borrowers that should be each completely comprehensive. So I think it'd be sufficient to just say student loan borrower or private or federal education loan borrower and not require both. I don't think that's the only instance of it, but that's one that jumped out to me.
Thank you for your comment. I believe we added the federal to a lot of this language because of comments received from the first workshop in writing. And I misunderstood, or maybe we put it in too many areas.
I think I was one of those commenters, and so okay. I just wanted to clarify that I think we offered, I think I'm looking back at my comment now, I think we suggested, like, in the alternative, you can have federal, or in the alternative, you can just take out, and take out student loan, or in the alternative, take out private education loan and keep student loan borrower. But as is, I just want to call up to your attention, if you all, upon review, think it's redundant, or if it's not redundant, you'll make whatever decision is appropriate. I just wanted to note that in case the prior comment was confusing.
Right. No. Okay. No. Understood. And, thank you.
And then if I can make a comment, I know it wasn't part of the summary, but on what is now Section 8, what previously was Section 7, which is requiring a private education lender, as defined in Section 7.1 of the bill, to obtain a license. We had initially commented that it would be helpful to have clarification as to that that requirement applies to both private education lenders as defined, that both extend credit and are holders of the loan, since that term includes both of those types of activities. And the edit here points back to that definition, which is helpful, but then it continues with the original text to specify that it's the extending private education loans that is the activity that requires licensure. So the point of clarification was more about including holders, which is the definition in the bill itself, and whether or not a holder of a loan that does not actually originate the loan needs to get licensed. If that comment is clear.
It is. I thought just having that definition of what it is in AB 332 covered both the extender of private student loans as well as holders.
Yeah, and I think the definition does, and that's the intent, but just the fact that adding the definition immediately afterward, it then says extending, and so it narrows back in on one of just of those two activities.
Okay.
Creates the potential for ongoing confusion.
Okay. We will definitely review that internally and with LCB. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you. And thank you again for all your work on this.
Do we have any other comments from the web?
We have no more web commenters.
Any that joined us by phone?
We have no phone commenters.
Okay, and not seeing any here in Las Vegas, we will continue. Where are we at? 16. Section 16. We revised the language to clarify what information must be provided to the division by a licensee with the annual report filing. Section 17, we added the term private education to clarify this section was for private education lenders. Section 18, we changed the language to make it clear that a borrower's consent to receive all communications electronically must be documented and proof of such must be retained by the licensee. Section 22, we removed the phrase in a timely manner and add it within 30 calendar days for a licensee to investigate any complaint received from a borrower concerning inaccurate credit reporting. We removed the term promptly and added the term immediately for a licensee to correct any negative information previously reported to a credit bureau as a result of an investigation. If anyone wishes to offer comments on Section 16, 17, 18, or 22, now's the time to do so. If you wish to make a comment on one of the proposed sections, please identify what section you are commenting on. Do we have any comments from those who joined us by web?
We have Scott from the web.
Scott, we are ready for you.
On Section 16, certainly appreciate all the changes you all have taken into consideration here. I think this is an improvement will help with the disclosure. I do want to highlight again, I think we made this comment before, but for Section 16A, for the APR, that is not something that is regularly calculated. And so to the extent that a servicer have that, it would be the APR that is disclosed in the total disclosure the borrower gets when these loans are originated, and APR is not recalculated. We think, you know, consideration, we understand sort of issues with statute, but the intent here, I think, is to capture what is the effective interest rate the borrower is paying at any given time, whether they've gotten a discount for some sort of for auto debit, or whether their loan is a variable rate, right, that increases over time. And capturing that interest rate would give a more precise snapshot of actually the costs that borrowers are incurring versus a calculation that is not made, once again, after disclosure. So again, I would encourage you to take a look at that and assess intent and whether that changes in regulatory text or is some consideration during examinations. We appreciate consideration. The other sections I would like to highlight is what are now subsections U and B, which is about the amounts placed in forgiveness, amounts canceled or discharged. Those are terms I would highlight. Forgiveness, canceled, or discharged are terms that are not precisely defined. And so generally those can be interchangeable in many respects, since sometimes they're associated with forgiveness programs that are federally based. On the private side, you may call it a cancellation or a discharge. And we would suggest perhaps grouping those together to get a more precise number, because otherwise, when you get a line item reporting amounts placed in forgiveness, some servicers may view some sort of transaction as a forgiveness versus a discharge, but they're combined together, forgiveness, and so the suggested revision would be U and would be U placed in forgiveness, canceled, or discharged. That would capture a snapshot that is comparable across servicers and would give you a sense, I think, of what the intent here is, the amount of loans that that are receiving some sort of relief in general across those buckets. Also, I would highlight with the amount of the loans as the sort of the caveat afterwards about the disclosure. We assume what you intend to capture is the amount of the forgiveness, cancellation, or discharge, but that's sort of dissonant to the previous sort of sections that are I think trying to capture what the amount is of loans that are in those statuses. So I'm not sure what exactly, I don't know whether you intend to capture the amount of the cancellation, forgiveness, or discharge, or if you intend to capture the principal and interest balance of the underlying loans prior to or after that cancellation or discharge. Clarity there would be helpful on those specific items because they're slightly different than the other ones.
Okay, we definitely will clarify that. I see. We know what we mean, but we will clarify it.
Okay, great. And then finally with W, the number of accounts with court initiated and status of those accounts, we assume what you mean is court initiated actions or litigation began by the servicer against the borrower, as opposed to what we already reported in MLS, which is activities or legal actions against the servicer. Based upon the section, we assume it's servicer initiated against borrowers, but we think that would be better clarified, and especially the term court action. I think you mean, and I not speculate, but I suppose what you're trying to capture is sort of litigation or activities that servicers take against borrowers. And we think that might be better clarified there, because we're 100% sure that that's what you mean versus what we reported in MLS, MLS today.
Yeah, and you were correct when you said that since this is reporting information on a borrower, that way you mean any kind of active or action taken against a borrower, not any action that a licensee received and is posting it in MLS. Two different things, but yeah.
Yeah, we just think that clarification would be useful. And then I'll make one since I think you group these together on section 17. I know we commented on this before, but trust accounts, this is language that is normally specifically applied to collection agencies for the reason that collection agencies who do this work oftentimes for their clients group those recoveries and then and remit back net of whatever their collection fees are amounts. And these provisions are generally designed to sort of protect the integrity of the collection system from collectors who otherwise might not make whole on their obligations back to the lenders in terms of payments. I'm not sure what the value is from a consumer perspective of having segregated trust accounts since in servicing versus collection, any payments that are received are applied directly to the account, not aggregated and rolled up to the lender. And so representing both those who are on the lender side as well as the servicer side, this provision I don't think we think provides any benefit to either party and doesn't provide any benefit to consumers and creates a real administrative burden, since servicers may be working for multiple lenders at any given time and maintaining separate trust accounts. When we don't hold money, we actually just apply that money directly on a loan account basis. We continue to think that Section 17 is numbered today is not necessary.
I have a question about that. When does the servicer actually pay the lender when they're servicing the loan?
So, the transactions flow, we don't pay the lender, and I think in the way that you think of a collection agency, when the payment comes in, it is applied to that loan, and then all the cash flows in real time, generally to the lender or holder.
So you automatically do, when you post it to the account, you automatically do the bank transfer to the actual holder of the account?
Sometimes that's delayed by several days depending upon account posting, but generally that's the case, is that, and oftentimes it's not the lender, it's a holder, it's a trust, whoever it might be, but those cash flows are generally, unlike in collections, which is, large amounts of cash can reside at the collection agency for extended periods of time. From a servicer perspective, that's not how it works.
And we, we'll have to discuss this internally because we, as you know, we do regulate collection agencies, and some of those collection agencies actually service not just student loan accounts, they service other industries as well. And they also have somewhat of the same model that you just kind of explained. And they utilize a trust account. So that's where we are coming from this. So we'll definitely have to look at this internally because it's very similar to what we're currently seeing now. So.
Yeah, no, and I understand that, and certainly, like I said, I'm aware these are not uncommon, especially on the collection side of things. We just, I think we would encourage you to think about what is the benefit from a consumer perspective for this provision, because it's speaking for both lenders and then the servicers themselves on either side, those two parties who are the ones who a trust account is designed to protect their relationship. We don't see that there's any benefit to this, to those two parties. And certainly if there's some benefit to consumers that you all think exists, then certainly have to talk about that. We just don't think it's more administrative burden that I don't think translates into any value to consumers themselves.
Okay, and I had a question about another comment that you had made about Section 16, which one, about the APR. Do the servicers receive the original loan document or the original contract or anything that originated the student loan?
We have access to it.
Okay.
That doesn't necessarily mean, I'll be clear, that it doesn't necessarily mean that we capture that in the in the servicing system of record as a data point that is actively pullable. We retain the promissory note and the total disclosures, and so have those. But that's sort of the challenge here, is that oftentimes the APR itself is retained as part of the data, as part of the file for that borrower, but performing regular data calls on that is not something that's possible today.
Okay.
Because it's never been required before.
Okay, so it'd be something more that we could pull during the examination with the loan file that we're going to pull versus us getting it annually, like you said, with the interest rate.
That's right. I mean, it will be absolutely part of, in the later sort of, data file requirements. I mean, to the extent it contains all of the total disclosures, you would have access to that. It's just not something that, I think the point of some of these other provisions in A, B, and C on this is sort of like real time, sort of what are the numbers today, and borrowers don't get redisclosed in APR.
Correct.
In 6 months later or 10 months later, unless they refinance that loan or consolidate that loan, then they would get. But in the normal servicing, what they are sort of disclosed is the interest rate that is applicable. And I think if you're looking to, in that section, get a snapshot over time of, have interest rates gone up, costs for borrowers gone up, have they gone down, what is the interest rate environment, interest rate will tell you that, whereas the initially disclosed APR, which is a fix-it thing, is not going to give you sort of that real-time look, and it's more challenging for us to provide in sort of a real-time data call.
Correct. Okay, thank you. Did you have any other comments since I took you back?
No, that's fine. That covers all of my comments.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any other comments from those who joined us by web?
No,
We have no more web commenters.
Any that joined us by phone?
We have no phone commenters.
Okay, and not seen any here in Las Vegas. So we have covered the sections with the changes made since the first workshop. If anyone wishes to discuss any of the other sections of the proposed regulations, now's the time to do so. So if you wish to make a comment on one of the proposed sections, please identify what section you are commenting on. Do we have anyone that would like to provide comment on any of the sections that joined us by web?
We have no web commenters.
Any that joined us by phone?
We have no phone commenters.
Okay, and not seen any here in Las Vegas. We will move on to agenda item number 4, final public comment. We will now open to final public comment. If anyone would like to make additional comments, now's the time to do so. There is no need to restate a comment already made. A public comment will be limited to 3 minutes per person. Comments will first be taken from those who joined us by web, second from those who joined us by phone, and lastly from those who joined us here in Las Vegas. For those who joined us virtually, you can provide public comment by typing an X in the chat box or calling the toll-free number at 1-844-621-3956. Jennifer, do we have anyone that would like to provide comment that joined us by web?
We have Scott from the web.
Scott from the web.
Yeah, not to go on, but I just want to thank all, especially for the consideration of previous comments. We appreciate sort of looking through those and working through those, and always happy to talk about these issues, and appreciate all the hard work all done. So thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comment.
We have no more web commenters.
Anyone that joined us by phone?
We have no phone commenters.
Okay, and not seen any here in Las Vegas. We will move on to item 5 on the agenda, which is close of the workshop. But before we do, just a reminder, if you haven't already signed in on the sign-in form in the chat box, please do so now. So we have it for the record so we can make sure we email you when we do the adoption hearing or if we need to have a third workshop. The second workshop pertaining to Assembly Bill 332 is hereby closed and adjourned on May 8th, 2024 at 10:28 a.m. Thank you.